Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to My Turn, Waypoint's movie podcast, where we take turns talking about a series of related films to draw connections and contrasts among them. I can at least guarantee the contracts part, if not always the relationships or the connections. So last time on My Turn, the audience voted for Ricardo's pick of Escape from New York, which is about a buccaneering war hero trying to rescue a corrupt president from a dystopia of his government's own making in the name of bringing World War III to a close. That got me thinking about what might be the polar opposite of Carpenter's grimy adventure, White House Down. So if you're not familiar with White House Down, that's probably because it was eclipsed by its doppelganger, Olympus Has Fallen. See, in 2013, Hollywood gave us two movies about a president coming under attack in his own White House, with the building being seized by small armies of commandos, only for their plot to be foiled by a bodyguard looking for redemption. Olympus Has Fallen, starring Gerard Butler and Aaron Eckhart, was a hit, and that spawned an ongoing franchise.
I was going to say, it became the Has Fallen franchise, right?
I was looking this up. Yeah, that's how it's listed on Wikipedia.
Three of them, I believe, were made.
And there's a fourth coming.
Uh-huh. And the third one introduced Gerald Butler's father, played by, oh, shit. I'll look it up. Continue.
So that becomes a franchise, while White House Down, starring Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx, was largely ignored and forgotten. The trouble is, it's actually a really funny twist on the venerable template laid down by Die Hard. Basically, White House Down is Die Hard, except Al the Cop has been replaced by Jamie Foxx playing a Barack Obama-esque president, and the global capitalist excess of the 80s has been traded in for the sentimental liberalism of the West Wing. The John McClane part is, of course, going to Channing Tatum playing John Cale, a Capitol police officer who is desperate to show his daughter he's not a disgraceful ne'er-do-well by getting a job with the Secret Service, because his daughter Emily is completely obsessed with the White House and the presidency.
can't show up to the kids, you know, talent show, but don't worry, what it's going to patch things up is if I can just get this White House job.
This fucking kid.
So he just happens to be there on the wrong day as a super group of neo-Nazis and mercenaries storm the building with the help of a treacherous right-wing Secret Service commander played by James Woods. Foxx and Tatum team up and bro down to defeat the plan, and at the end, American democracy has been defended, a radical plan for global peace has been adopted, and a little girl can look at her father without shame. So, gang, that's all preamble. I think my first question for y'all is simple and fairly just high level. So this movie was a commercial failure. I am curious, do you feel it's a failure by other metrics as well, or is this a secret success?
This movie fucking owns. Shut the fuck up. You're all wrong. Yes.
I'm not saying I didn't have a good time. But
every frame of this every second of this film I watched was a fucking joy. For me, it was one of the dumbest fucking things I've ever seen, and every moment of it brought me increasing levels of enjoyment. I love this autistic child so much. Emily Cale's special interest is the White House, is the president. It is the most endearing shit on the planet. I think this movie fucking owns. It's so dumb. And the action choreography solid.
So I am a huge Roland Emmerich fan, the director of this film. Independence Day, one of my all-time favorite big, dumb.
They make that reference.
Stargate, Universal Soldier. Not really going to defend Godzilla. Don't remember The Patriot. Is The Patriot good, Rob?
Wait, whoa, whoa, whoa. He directed The Patriot?
Yes.
The Mel Gibson vehicle?
Yes. Day After what? Tomorrow.
Day After Tomorrow, secretly entertaining as hell.
I didn't see 10,000 BC. So this is all to say. So like this is the arc. Like essentially Roland Emmerich with his co-director, Dean Devlin. They did a bunch of films together, including Independence Day, Godzilla. Godzilla sort of broke them because that movie was a really like kind of a weird flop, even though it was a financial success. And Emmerich goes off to continue making disaster porn. Which is what Independence Day is. That's what Day After Tomorrow is. And it's like, do you want to watch the Eastern Seaboard fall apart? We asked artists to just do it again. And I ate that shit up. But around this era is essentially where Emmerich like completely loses the plot on their ability to like properly direct big blockbuster CG-driven action. I agree with you, Ren, that like it's not unwatchable. But as a Emmerich fan, like, the heights to which this director falls at this era in which this is the... So he makes White House Down. Can you even guess the movie that Roland Emmerich, like, star of disaster porn cinema, makes after this?
No.
A dramatization of the Stonewall Riots.
Wait, not the musical one.
No.
Not this. No, okay.
He makes Stonewall, and then he makes Independence Day Resurgence. Awful movie. One of my
Roland Emmerich.
And then most recently directed Moonfall, a movie that even among my folks around me that are like, hey, I love bad, messy, expensive cinema, Moonfall is an unwatchable mess. And so this movie comes at a really interesting time in Emmerich's career. I had a good time with it, but I don't think there was a world, and I'll end with this. There was a world where Emmerich was able to balance, I have made for you a big, dumb movie, but you're going to have a good time on the roller coaster. And a movie like Independence Day epitomizes that. White House Down is a movie that I had a good time with, but not because Emmerich guided and structured a good roller coaster. It's just a fucking mess that is expensive and delightful to look at.
Real quick, I had just assumed the Stonewall movie was a musical based on the poster. Look at the poster for the Stonewall movie. And like,
no, that's how you know it's gay, Rob.
if there's one thing that I bet Stonewall looked like, it was a bunch of happy kids just like hanging out, strolling down the street together.
Snapping their fingers.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Well, I'm morbidly curious now. Okay. I'm somewhere between you, Kato. I'm curious. Where did you come down after getting off the roller coaster?
Basically that meme. You know that fucking the meme. Worst guy you know has a valid point. That's kind of how I felt about this movie. Is like, they're saying things that don't align with the rest of the ideology in this film. I feel like they're like pointing things out that the people in these situations would never point out or would be in a way that they weren't.
This is one of the most, I mean, it is the most, one of the most ideologically inconsistent movies I've ever seen, in the way that like 100%. All neoliberalism, all highly neoliberal art is some of the most ideologically inconsistent shit you've ever seen, because it is an ideologically inconsistent worldview, right? But like, that inconsistency makes it such a weird, stupid thing to interact with. Man,
presuming this has an ideological viewpoint is...
Oh, 100% does.
It does. It has like seven and they're all really dumb, which is why I like it.
I think having seven different viewpoints does not add... I don't think it's a math problem.
Here's the thing. I think the movie is not so much neoliberal. It's made under like, you know, in like the era of the triumph of neoliberalism, but it's a deeply just liberal movie.
Yes, I think.
The West Wing parallels, like, I think are where a lot of this stems from, because the West Wing was very much invested in the aesthetics and trappings of power, but also imagined like, what if really good and decent people were in charge of all that power. And that's like present from the start of this film.
The fucking walk and talks are so funny. All the walk and talks in this movie. The villains are doing walk and talks. The heroes are doing walk and talks. It's so fucking dumb. I love it. As you're saying, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, but like it is so like heart on its sleeve. The moment we open on, hey, the president just wants to buzz the Capitol because he just loves America so much. He wants to be inspired by the monuments. But also, hey, you know, liberalism is a deeply ingrained American tradition.
Hold on. I feel like we can't actually skip over the real actual first thing that we see right before we move into the helicopters.
Yeah.
Is the child whose name is Emily.
Yeah.
Emily
getting a breaking news alert that has for some reason an accept or reject button on the alert. Yes. But also apparently she just has like a Google alert for
she customized her
middle,
whole phone.
Middle East news.
I love this child. She's so good. Her special interest is politics, and she is so excited about it.
That's so broad though. Like, what is the alert? I'm like super focused on like how do you get an alert for that specific news bit? Like, is it Middle East? Is it just like war? Is it?
I mean, the alert is pretty significant. That is the kind of thing that would pop up on your phone. If right now, if we were at war and Joe Biden was right now, just like, yeah, I think I'm just going to like do sweeping policy change throughout the Middle East. Well, you would probably get a notification in your phone.
But yeah, but hold on, though. It would have happened a day ago, but she gets the alert because of time zones. She gets the alert first thing in the morning. But the real thing is, she's like waiting for the president to fly back to DC like Santa is arriving.
Yes.
Like that is the whole shot is like a Christmas commercial. She opens her eyes like the president is back in the White House.
For all the shitposting I'm doing, I think Emily is really well characterized in this specific way. I know people who are like this about really dumb shit. And like all of this lands for me. All of this lands.
No, I mean, this is the problem. Like there's so much in this movie that's like goofy as shit, but also I think deeply likable is the thing I would like characterize every single choice they make in this movie. It ends up being carried off to some degree because the people executing it are deeply likable and they make the characters deeply likable.
Right.
And that even includes like, you know, Fox's president talking about like, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, was a suffragist before suffragism was an active movement. And, you know, when they land at the White House, we get the beaming Maggie Gyllenhaal and the spare Secret Service agent who's just going to be murked later in the film. Is this the greatest job in the world? Yeah.
Is it?
I can imagine better jobs than being a bodyguard to the president and like being like, all right, gang, I'm going to go sleep now. You go hang out around this house.
Everyone would be terrified to be in an airplane that's flying that low to the ground.
Oh no! If I could be like, yeah, let's drop to the deck. I absolutely would every chance. That is the best pilots. Like absolutely, like let's do it. But we get the whole like, you know, we have the long sequence, and that's the other thing. When I make the parallels to Die Hard, it's not just about the. I don't think it's just a matter of the conceits of the film, which I mean, this movie is like beat for beat mimicking a lot of Die Hard. But also, I think a lot of like one of the things that really makes Die Hard stand out is that there's almost nothing in that film that is wasted. Everything comes back up later in some sort of like crucial context. And
that's not how Roland Emmerich makes movies, right?
But actually the script does. Yeah.
So it comes from James Vanderbilt, who has done you can see a lot of the DNA of some other films that they've worked on. Like they would go on to do some of the modern Scream films, Ready or Not, which is a horror comedy. They also did the Slender Man film. the writer of Zodiac, the Fincher movie, two amazing Spider-Mans. But there is a through line through a number of Vanderbilt's works of like slim, effective mashups of action and comedy, which in theory is what Emmerich does. I was like, that's Independence Day. That's you know, Day After Tomorrow. So I can't tell what failed here was like the script or Emmerich came in and went, I've got this. I'm going to put a little of the Emmerich touch because Emmerich does co-write a lot of the films that they work on. And I don't know where that falls here, because I get the feeling watching it that the script was probably smarter than the product that ended up here.
I think when I think of Emmerich, I do think he's a dude who loves big process shots, always has. He's always been like that kind of director. And the weird thing is, you know, this is something that's easier to imagine as someone who's like being made by someone who's a little more interested in like pacing and procedure, a bit in, you know, a bit in the way that Die Hard is. Mm-hmm. But like we do at least have the sequence where they lay out all the layers of security around the White House, all the systems that are put in place. And it's all very like competence porn in some ways, but it's important to like lay all this out, because we're also going to see all these locations wiped out and turned against like the White House, like in the next like sequence in the film. But it's
the snipers, the snipers noticing the open sliding door and then the infrared turning on, and it's just two people having sex in their apartment. It's so ridiculous.
And one of the things I find actually kind of interesting about the competence porn aspect is the ways in which I think that I've been thinking a lot about this movie's action choreography. It feels like it's so, and the references to Die Hard you're making, I think it's like riding this interesting line between the competence porn-esque perfect military precision style of action choreography that we've talked about on the show before, and the more like messy, I'm just going to shoot a bunch in this fucking room style of action choreography. Yes. And the film is trying to do both at the same time in ways that I find kind of endearing, honestly. Channing Tatum as dude who will just spray in a room is just, it's so good.
So let's talk about, because he's the next character we meet. And I think one of the things that makes this film really work is that there's something that Channing Tatum is really good at bringing across, which is that he can give such well-meaning lunk vibes, and you can absolutely believe he's incredibly good at things and also believe he's a lifelong fuck up. And that's the entire point of this next sequence as he's being introduced, where like, you know, you get like the bit with the squirrel that establishes him kind of a sweetheart. But the whole thing that is like leading up to him, you know, desperately trying this job interview is the fact that he's got a tense relationship with his kid. And I love the little beat there where she's waiting for the knock when he comes to pick her up, and then immediately throws on her headphones so that she can pretend she's completely tuned out, and makes her mom go and get the door. And like adopts the like I don't give a shit about you, John, persona. And again, the fact that this movie's going to hang the flag twirling thing on the wall, and we even have a little bit of the Sorkin-esque shittiness of, you know, when he learns he's missed the talent show, and you know, his ex-wife informs him she did flag twirling, and his immediate response is that's a talent. Which is a horrible thing to say about so your kid's talent snarky. Show thing, but also very funny.
Right. Like, that's the other thing with the script, is like, it's a funny script. Like, there's a lot of good jokes in here, or like jokes that aren't good, but did make me laugh a lot. That was one of them. The pen is mightier than the sword is one of the stupidest lies.
I don't think these jokes are very funny, but like, you have performers doing hammy interpretations. I mean, like the final line from Jamie Foxx doing the meme of like I'm dead, but you know, whatever, the one where like the guy pulls the gun from his coat, but like death, but not for me. Anything.
Yes, it's so good. Stupid.
But that's what I can't square it here. Like it makes it. It's a bizarre like tonal film that I can't figure out.
I think for me, like the juxtapositions are kind of why it remains so interesting. It is like the slightly ramshackle nature of this thing. It's like, it's a modularly designed film where we're doing like little bits and beats. And we get, And we get weird little things. You insert, it does feel like they are laying the groundwork for a franchise, given like the characters that you got. Maggie Gyllenhaal in a fairly thankless role, where she's going to do a lot of like, she's gonna, just going to be a voice on the headset for a lot of the film. But she and Tatum have a great scene together where he applies for this job.
It's so good, and also the movie wants them to fuck so badly. It is desperate for those two people.
Well, they've already hooked up, right? That's yes, clearly in yes, the like their yes, study sessions yeah, was
yeah,
like
yeah, college, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It, but it wants these two people, like that the sequel to this movie is those two hitting it off, right? Like it is them working together and some other incident happening where instead of Emily being at risk, it instead is Gyllenhaal and Tatum like going through a situation together, right?
I just love the again, like, you know, why does this kind of work? Why do we kind of get invested in this character? I think Tatum brings in this whole sequence a lot of vulnerability that is key mm-hmm. to making the work, the film work, because the thing that he gets sort of hit with the double blast of here is that, one, he's a dude without credentials applying for a job where he does not meet or even come close to the minimum like credential requirements to get it. Mm-hmm. And so it's that one tier of rejection of like, you shouldn't even be here. Like you, right. like you're applying for the wrong role. You shouldn't be in this conversation.
Right.
And then there's the other thing of, he has amassed a track record as not necessarily being a fuck up, but a guy who's like totally rudderless mm-hmm. and very fitful in terms of like what, like when he shows up to a thing or when he invests himself in it. And it's not just that he's amassed that track record through his life, but Gyllenhaal's character knows him and is able to call him on all that. And so he's sort of faced with this, like this whole job interview becomes this really horrible, but like really identifiable look in the mirror for this mm-hmm. character, as he's sort of forced to see like, this is how I come across to other people. And by the way, that's how his family sees him too.
Yeah. I mean, the way he crumples when she reads the one of the reports from one of his military commanders, where it's yeah. like, he's really competent. He is overwhelmingly competent and will not ever get anything done. And it's heartbreaking. And like, him hearing that and then just crumpling immediately is it's so grim. And I think that like this is one of Tatum's strengths as an actor, right? Is that he is really good at playing a hot, sad man, but it is always a very specific kind of sadness that is distinct from the like grim, dark Robert Pattinson sadness. It is a quieter and goofier sadness that manages to really land in the moments where the camera actually turns to face it, and then it will very quickly turn away, and so it gives his like performances a lot of additional depth just from like the way his characters are framed, and I think he plays it very well.
He's just a better actor, right? Like right. he's like Tatum is cut from a mold of a lot of otherwise generic looking white guy, yeah. muscular white guys that are shoved into like action comedy hybrids, which you could throw like actors like The Rock in, right? Mm-hmm. And then like these actors span a real spectrum. Like The Rock has like no range whatsoever, no. right? And you see that play out in the course of their career, to getting something like Black Adam, which is, well, I just won't talk very much, and I'll let the CG do the talking. And you have Tatum. This movie comes right alongside like the breakout performance that like turns like Tatum. Well, two of them. There's 21 Jump Street, which like solidifies him as a comedic actor, and then you have Magic Mike that solidifies him as a dramatic actor. And then this movie sort of like lands squarely in this period where he's actually finding an identity for himself that allows him to take on roles and give a role like this more than whether it's the script or the filmmaker, I don't know, but it's all there only because of
yes.
Channing Tatum and his ability to play like bulky brick of a man, but like one that you want to like hold, and it's right. okay if they cry.
Yeah. He's one of those actors where like, I would almost like, I would kill for a movie written for Channing Tatum in the same way that something like Uncut Gems was written for Adam Sandler, where it's just like, let me put this guy in a position that, let me put this person in a role that they're not normally in, but I think that they're fundamentally built for. I want to say that movie's so fucking bad.
Soderbergh
is
making a third Magic Mike movie, right? That's the,
yes. So that's the closest we get. Like, he does seem also just like an actor that likes to have a good time and like is clearly picking, you know, has anyone seen Logan Lucky?
No.
Oh, that's a recent Soderbergh Tatum collaboration that came out of the Magic Mike stuff. It's so fucking good. He's great in that as well. But he like seems to sort of he clearly does not pick like explicitly dramatic roles in the way that and I don't know if that's a choice or like typecasting, and like he's just found himself in a way that like he's playing just sort of the similar sorts of roles over and over, and then is able to elevate them when he gets partnered with a Soderbergh who like really understands like what does it mean to put this like incredible looking physical figure that can also move you in front of the camera, which makes the Magic Mike movie so fucking good.
So the other thing lurking in the background of, actually, you know what, let's close the loop on this. So the interview goes horribly, and then it's the worst thing I can imagine happening to you at this moment after bombing a job interview happens. Like, the president walks into the tour group after he evades the question of how the job interview went and sort of implies like, yeah, he's gonna, it went all right. And Emily immediately is like, that means dad's getting the job and he's going to be on the president's detail. And so the president walks in on the tour group. And this is like, this is where I think the president, Jamie Foxx's character is going to win us over a bit. But also kind of like have that tiny bit of edge the character needs so that like the buddy team up later can have some weight after being surprised by like her surprisingly trenchant question. Hang on, quick thing. We need to back up. His Middle East peace plan. Have we all caught what the Middle East peace plan is? So, and this is what I mean about this movie being like incredibly liberal. Just in its sensibilities. It's just in the background, but we get enough to get a sense of like what he has spelled out. He has decided that, one, as we all know, poverty is the root of all like ills across any region. It can always be reduced to poverty. He learned this in his lens on domestic politics and what he's going to apply to the world at large. Two, it's the military-industrial complex that has been keeping us divided from one another across the world, but especially in the Middle East. President al-Sharif, I think of Iran, but might be from a different country.
It's Iran.
Has the documents showing the ways the military-industrial complex has been spinning plots and counterplots to keep everyone at each other's throats. His solution is twofold. One, we're going to pull out of the Middle East, close all the bases. We don't need them anymore. We're just getting out of the region. Two, we are going to publish the documents. He's basically going to Panama Papers, the military industrial complex, and show that they are the ones behind all these events in the Middle East. And that is going to break the logjam, and Israel, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, China, everybody is going to get on board with this like global peace plan that amounts to it was the arms dealers all along.
I mean, it's a Scooby-Doo reveal. Like, it is a Scooby-Doo reveal is what he wants to do.
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason this movie spends. The reason when you asked, what is the plan? And three people blinked because the movie introduces it as a MacGuffin, well, and then says goodbye. Like, we're not going to talk about this till the end.
They drip it in throughout. The thing about the Panama Papers thing doesn't happen till much later in my notes, at least.
He actually brings it up. So this is important. He brings it up as a conversation with the speaker, the avuncular, centrist, conservative, who is Kale's actual protectee. He hops on a phone call with Jamie Foxx, and Jamie Foxx says al-Sharif has the documents, which is, so he tells the speaker like that's where the, like we have the Scooby-Doo reveal like plan in motion. So Emily asks him about this, and he gives the, you know, when we give up on thinking that people, different people can come together, that's when we've given up on the world. And then he gives a cool shout out to her on her YouTube channel. But then
it's not a blog.
Nobody says blog anymore. Mm-hmm.
I just learned blog.
And she tells him, my dad's going to be on your detail. And he grabs him, whispers in his ear, Don't lie to kids, man.
Don't lie to kids.
It's so brutal. It is such a good line. Such a good, ugh. Jamie Foxx is also great in this. I think he's clearly having a ball with this role. And it makes me.
Similar profile of like great dramatic actor with great like comedy chops as well. And I feel like a similar case of like Hollywood not fully knowing.
Yeah, Hollywood's like largely failed Jamie Foxx. Please look up, not that you need to see yet another Donald Trump impression, but if you've not seen Jamie Foxx's Donald Trump, it is one of the most unfucking canny things I have ever seen.
And he sat on it for 5 years, right? He didn't do.
Yeah, he didn't make it. He wasn't going on SNL. Like, wasn't banking on it. It was just like on a podcast recording that he was doing and like busted out, and the room just stops on a dime. And he is just truly like one of the all time like great modern actors. And I mean, like, it's been a million years since he was in Ray, which I think was like, you know, maybe I'm blanking on some of the other like recent films he's been that have really been like his dramatic chops. But he also seems like a guy that likes to have fun too. So he ends up picking a lot of roles that has him. Yeah. You don't end up in a movie like this because you need it. Yeah. Well, Channing Tatum does, but like at that point in his career, but Jamie Foxx, probably not.
And so with that, like we meet, we get our inkling of the plot taking shape. You know, we see that James Woods is doing all the things that, you know, he ain't coming home. We see him getting ready for the day at the office, taking his American flag pin off his lapel. So, you know, things are serious. Puts it by the dog tags draped over the photo of his son in Marine dress uniform. He goes into work and he's clearly out of it in the briefing, and warns Gyllenhaal's character, you know, don't make this your whole life. It's not worth it. And the idea that all these things it'll be revealed. This is a guy who's lost his faith, right? He no longer believes this is the greatest job in the world or the greatest country in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, his politics are the switches that this movie does in terms of what he believes and what his actual desires are, I think are kind of interesting. Like, I think they're like fascinating in a way. Like, this switch from he is the dude who lost his son and wants revenge on the country to no, that is not what is happening here. He does not want revenge on the United States. He is fundamentally a hawk who will only ever see the world through that lens. He is so bought into this idea of how power functions that when his son is killed on the president's order, he's like, damn, didn't go far enough. Fucked up.
But and also, it cannot be overlooked that around this period, I don't know when James Woods goes full, like, right-wing.
He was never that far in the closet as far as, like, what his
politics
like, were.
But, like, yeah. I don't think it was in the public eye to the degree that it is now. Like, this... His like full mask off, like fuck it, I'm feasting on the fascism happens in the Trump era. But like as soon as it became clear that James Woods is a villain in this film, I was like, is he just doing a role playing fantasy in this film? Because a lot of what he's doing like doesn't seem that far off from things that like James Woods might be tweeting about all the time. It was actually like mildly disturbing. Like I can't imagine he was cast because like actually his politics neatly fit with the character we're playing. That is just a happy little accident. But it was like kind of unsettling to watch that play out with the context of what he has become as a public figure, much more well known for right wing politics than any of the acting he's done in recent years.
I think it's one of the things that makes the movie interesting is the fact that it is like. It is so the weird thing is it is tapping into like consciously or not, but I think mostly consciously it is tapping into a lot of like latent dreads of the Obama era. Right. The fact that like the people who take over the White House where White House Down is like, man, it's all these foreign adversaries in every movie. Like, oh no, we're under attack from a threat from abroad. Right. And it will take Gerard Butler to put it right. Here,
Olympus has fallen. Like,
pardon?
Oh, you said White House Down. Sorry. Olympus has fallen.
Yeah, the Has Fallen series. Yes, yeah. Yes. But here, it's explicitly like, it is a mix of like private military contractors and right-wing militia that take over the White House. The dude, like one of the lead attackers in this film, is the dude who played Devil in Justified, who was like Boyd Crowder's right-hand man.
Oh, that's what he was from. I didn't bother looking at IMDb, but I was constantly going, I know you from something. And I could not put my finger on it, but you are
right. He's got a bunch of like, not random, but like loosely like associated tattoos all over him, like marking affiliations with different causes that don't even necessarily all fit in the same bucket, but like just a lot of like extremist paramilitary shit. Like
he's a neo-Nazi grab bag. Like that is his character, is the neo-Nazi grab bag of just like, he's into all of it, man.
Yeah. Like it's, you know, that's just sort of staffing out the attack. And again, like, you know, 2013, I think this is around the time that you have the report on radicalization and law enforcement being like intentionally buried at the behest of like Republicans who, you know, cried foul at the notion of like pointing out the fact that like armed security services are shot through with Nazis. And then, yeah, the ultimate villain here is James Woods, who, yeah, we do learn. You think the entire movie that it is about anger over his son being killed in a Jimmy Carter-esque like raid on Iran. But actually what his fundamental objection to Jamie Foxx's character is aesthetic. Like, yes. And this is where the fascism comes in. It is that, you know, in the climax of the film, he's going to say, like, for a minute, you showed you had what it takes. For 1 minute, you were what an American president should be. But, you know, then you let us all down. You failed us yet again. And it is because in his worldview, the job of an American president is to exalt in American power and wield American power, violent power, unapologetically and frequently.
And without like retort. Like his whole point is that if you did the thing the American president is supposed to do, the world is in its right way, right? Like his fundamental belief is that if I bomb Iran, we will be able to completely end the war in the Middle East because we will just obliterate the entire region. And that is the ideal role of the American empire, is to be the hand pulling that trigger.
Well, and that is also, again, this is where I wonder about the script versus like as it was in Vanderbilt's hands, and then when Emmerich is shooting it. Emmerich's films, especially ones that are in this disaster porn category, are all U.S.-centered, American military-centered, like very much in the mode of making the, you know, the military and American like culture like sexy and interesting. Like that is a through line in all of is Day After Tomorrow, 10,000 not Day After Tomorrow. You know, Independence Day, like that is a through line in this is in that same mode of film. And so it's interesting that even though this there's a critique of a certain style of patriotism in this script, it is still ultimately a film that is Michael Bay like, and it's like, but yeah, like,
it loves the
America's
troops.
Great though.
Right. I mean, like that is the core, is that at every point where
America's flawed, but it's great.
A capital T troop is given an opportunity to make a decision in this movie, right? They always make the correct decision, or like the decision that is like most humane, right? We see that in the, and not troops, like we're not politicians. Politicians are always making the, not always, but consistently making the morally wrong decision, from Woods' character to Woods is the Secret Service.
Richard Jenkins' character.
Jenkins, yes. Jenkins' character. are consistently making inhuman decisions. But when it comes to the troops, when they're like, the nuclear missiles are arming, something's wrong. Point one, when they're actually doing the airstrike and they go, no, there's a kid waving a flag. That means we can't do the airstrike, which is like, I'm aborting. It is so fucking silly.
Oh,
and
God.
So fundamentally divorced from how people who do violence actually understand it, but like it's so goofy, but to the point where I almost find it endearing. But yeah, I mean, you're right. The film fundamentally loves the troops so much and just wishes those darn politicians would stop using them for ill ends.
Darn politicians, those darn aliens, that darn climate change. Exactly. Like that's like that, like there's always, damn, people always just gunning for America. If they just leave us alone, we could make everything right. There's a real rah-rah cinematic. Emmerich comes out of the Michael Bay mold. Emmerich is just a less talented Michael Bay. And I think you especially see that in this film. White House Down, directed by Michael Bay. Oh, we cook him with gas.
Best thing since The Rock.
Right. Unfortunately, you see what it, you know, Emmerich, as much as I love his big popcorn films, like you see the talent gap in pulling off like a film of that type, especially when this movie is smaller scale, right? It is bombastic. It wants to be bombastic in a way that an Independence Day is, but it just fundamentally isn't. It is not a one room play, but it is like a small contained area, and it constantly tries to feel bigger. And every time it does that, I think it really buckles under that weight. And it's at its best when it's the sequence of the
commandos flying in through Washington, like the CG helicopters. It's like
awful.
It's like rolling so this. Bad. Like, how did nobody talk you out of this horrible idea?
Oh no, we gotta get under the arch in Chinatown.
It sucks so bad. And then also, I think that the other scene that I think really goes to show the point you're making, Patrick, and I think that is really goofy, but also like I think does not land at all for as much as I enjoyed watching it, is the car chase on the White House lawn where Channing Tatum is just spending like 5 minutes. There is five consecutive minutes of Channing Tatum just doing donuts.
We just gotta go around the fountain one more time, bro.
One more time.
You dropped the rocket launcher? That was a good line.
That's a good one. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's good. Like, the problem is that, like,
cutting to the helicopter, like, I believe we see the president has a rocket launcher. Like, that is art.
Right, that that's is the art. Problem, is that, like, for all of the ways in which the pacing of that scene is fucking awful, I think the action choreography at times that scene is really goofy. The fact that they introduced a minigun and then made it feel weightless is astounding. That is the worst minigun that has ever fired. And I know the presidential limousine, blah, 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 blah. Who gives a fuck?
They introduced that really early on. Didn't you remember?
I know.
It can survive like a nuclear blast or
something. I know. But it's so goofy. And it loses me in the middle. But then they go through the fucking tennis court. They drive through the tennis court and then the car sideswipes the basketball hoop and flips. And then I'm fully back in again. Like, every time the film's pacing completely ruins it for me, the next moment it wins me back with showing me the stupidest shit I can imagine.
Yeah, it's like, and I think it helps that there's a lot of chemistry like between the leads. Like every time Sawyer and Tatum... Fox and Tatum, Sawyer and Kale are together and sort of growing out. You see the buddy action movie take shape. And you wish there was more of it. Like their banter in the car is good. Them doing donuts on the White House lawn during a sort of inner action sequence is not good. And they just didn't figure out, like they did not figure out a compelling enough action sequence to leverage the inherent goofiness of driving around with the president in the backseat of a limo trying to work an RPG launcher. And you're driving this like, you know, 8-ton limousine. That's inherently funny. The stunt just doesn't quite the sequence doesn't quite like live up to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is part of the difficulty of, I almost wonder if, and this is to Patrick's point about it being too small of a movie, I almost wonder if the film works significantly better if it's all of Capitol Hill. just like this is a larger scale action.
I thought they were going to leave. That, like, that was the that whole, like, finally we can get out of the fucking White House and give a little, like, because like, you can see Emmerich, like, struggle, like, the way he handles spectacle is a zoomed out camera so that you can watch a massive visual effects a thing play out. And so you see when the helicopter sequence doesn't really work because it's zoomed in, it's clearly entirely CG. Yeah. It's not as like they're like, and it just falls apart. It also doesn't help that it's 10 years later and not in 4K. Where's my 4K White House down? But I think you're absolutely right, Ren, that, like, given a larger canvas to play on, it would help establish scenes for the players to have more intimate moments, and also not like you see the movie like, we need the big action moment. And it's like, we don't have a lot of pieces to work with here.
Yeah. And I think that's a bummer, because, again, there are moments where it works. But also, like, I think this goes to, like, the discohesion at the heart of this movie, which for some of us on this call really works. And for others, it totally falls through, because, like, that contrast is also, like, the present in the moment to moment of these action scenes. Right. There's that one. There's the quick bit where Tatum goes into spec ops fucking tier one operator mode and, like, knifes two guys, and then completely the whole tone and, like, structure of the film's action scenes changes for, like, a couple of scenes, and then switches right back, because it feels like the movie wants to play on two different scales at the same time but has confined its setting to one of them.
Well, I want to talk about some of the different action modes this movie is in a moment. Let's take a quick break before we dip into that, though.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I think y'all are keying on something really important here, which is that, like, fundamentally this movie would be best served by just being a diehard scale film and directed as such. And it's kind of stuck between different modes of filmmaking an action movie that have sort of emerged since. Like, Emmerich can't help but try and make a sprawling like CG spectacle, despite the fact that, like, the scale of this film, the scale of DC, does not lend itself to that. You know, it is the film is fundamentally doing the diehard thing, or the 80s, early 90s action film thing of, like, you know, an average Joe who's sort of quick on his feet and has a hefty layer of plot armor on him in some ways, you know, like getting the better of heavily armed mercenaries through, like, wit and guile and ingenuity. And there's bits and pieces of that. But then also, yeah, it wants to do the tier one operator shit of, like, well, also, like, he can be efficient and violent and, you know, and sort of, like, clear room like nobody's business. And the problem is that, like, Emmerich really can't do either of those two modes. You know, Emmerich does keep defaulting to, you know, I point the camera at where the big action thing is happening and the big action thing happens in front of it. And so even, like, you easily imagine places that you'd have much more compelling action sequences, like, you know, when those initial gunfights in the halls of the White House, for instance, it's claustrophobic. It's, you know, it's this game of cat and mouse in a tiny building. And there's ways to leverage that to make it more compelling. And I think Emmerich is mostly confined by it and wants to get away from it as soon as possible, which is too bad, because I do think, like, one of the strongest sequences in the film is when they get back to the residence. the two bits I love. Jamie Foxx, when he gets hold of his Nicorette stash and we cut to him with his jaw basically dislocated from the wad of Nicorette. He's just compulsively chewing.
Do you smoke?
Bug-eyed.
No. Great. I don't either. It's incredible. And I think that, like, part of the thing that you're talking about, Rob, with, like, he doesn't know what to do with that specific choreography. I mean, that shows in the pacing. That sequence is
this movie is long. When I booted it up last night, and I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding me, this movie is over 2 hours long. That's not what these movies... Is this a director's cut? I don't need that. I don't need this one.
We spend like 20 minutes with the vice president on Air Force One, and his whole purpose is to be blown out of the sky eventually to clear the way for the final release.
But it's a whole subplot.
Yeah.
Yes.
And like, the part of that's even like the minute-to-minute choreography and like pacing is fucked because he's uncomfortable. This vibe, like that exact gunfight you're talking about, that is claustrophobic. He is trying to get out of that shit so quickly. Like, as the characters are trying to get out of it, the movie is also like with Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx being like, we gotta go. We cannot be in this mode for very long because I don't know how to choreograph this action scene beyond there are a bunch of guys in a hallway and... It doesn't know what to do with those puzzle pieces. And instead it's just like, just put them in the elevator and have them climb up the elevator so we can get the sequence.
I don't know. Do I need a fourth? You know what? This movie already had three of them, but could I get like four or five fights where Channing Tatum is just fruitlessly engaging in hand to hand combat with a guy shot in a way that I don't understand the tension or the choreography? I mean, they go on forever and they have no weight whatsoever.
The biggest sequence in this movie is when the commandos are like, when the like SEAL team or whatever Delta Force is coming to land at the White House and they get totally wiped out by Javelin missiles, which bugs me because that's surface to surface missile and should have been like Stinger anyway. Point is, wrong weapon system. But the second thing is, like, this should be an absolute like batshit, like, you know, everything is popping off in this action sequence. And I'm surprised how uninvolved I am throughout the sequences. Like, the helicopters are shooting at the building and Channing Tatum's like mixing it up with the dudes and trying to like stop them from shooting down more choppers. And
that is the only good part of that sequence.
Why? The only good part of that sequence is when Channing Tatum is actually under threat by the Delta Force unloading a minigun at him. Like, that was goofy in a way that I actually liked. As part of the rest of that sequence was just empty, right? And like the fight that follows it between Tatum and the chief mercenary that they're working with.
Stenz.
So Stenz. And real quick here. So Stenz is played by Jason Clarke, who is one of those actors that never really gets his breakthrough, but he's in a few really good TV shows. He's a very good character actor, and is actually star of Chicago Code, which is a surprisingly good one season like cop show that has a degree of like cop skepticism that's rare. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, and I think it's a reason, like, we remember Stenz because like he's memorable. In a movie where a lot of the dudes are not.
Right. But the fight between Stenz and Kale is so long. Like, Stenz is throwing Kale around what looks like a press briefing room for, I'm going to say, about five consecutive minutes of just cutting between other things happening and Tatum getting the shit beat out of him. And then he, like, grabs a knife and stabs Stenz once in the foot. And then the fight's over because Tatum puts a grenade belt around his neck and then pulls the pins. And then I'm back in again. They got me. Sorry. I'm back in, fuckers.
Makes me so much too. Like, oh, grenade pins are so hard to pull. Like, by design, you don't just, it's not like a zipper. But yeah, that shit's fun. The entire, like, so one of the things I dig about this movie too is, like, one of the ways I think it's ahead of the curve is that it is so skeptical of mainstream conservatism back in 2013 as anything other than a smokescreen for something awful and rotten at its heart. Yes. We meet the Speaker of the House that we meet is like, wow, he's a cool guy, like a John McCain type or something. Like, seems like a really decent dude who's like, I'm not cool enough to be president. I can never be a dude like Sawyer, but he's a good buddy for Tatum, sort of a good sponsor for him. And you spend this whole movie thing like, This is one of the good guys. Mm-hmm. And the movie sort of tips its hand about like the levels of reveals we're going to have when they bring in James Woods' wife to talk sense into him.
Oh, it's so
and we
good.
Get the whole scene by the numbers. Like, yeah. Why are you doing this? I can't believe, like, you know, she's shocked. She doesn't know what's happening. She's confused. And then the turn comes and she's like, kill them all.
Right. She goes like, this is ideology moment for me. It's like, No. This is not a guy. This is not one fucked up dude. This is at this core, this is all it takes to flip this woman. She is against her husband doing this until the moment he evokes, we are going to kill more people and it will be good. And then it's like, okay, cool, great. Like, she is fully bought in. It's really well done.
And like, that sets us up for like the fact that, you know, at the end, who has been behind this whole thing? It's gonna turn out to be your avuncular, cool Speaker of the House. And the entire, you know, in the denouement where everyone's like on the White House lawn and it's all congratulations and the threat has been, you know, defeated. When he is caught via the, you know, his old fashioned addiction to having a beeper. But when he is caught, he immediately turns on Tatum and basically like indicates that he sees Kale the exact same way that Gyllenhaal and like the Secret Service application perceive a guy like Kale, except even worse, even more contempt. You know, who are you? You dumb meathead grunt. Who are you to get in my way? And I think like it's one of the cool moves in this movie is that like, you know, sometimes it's interesting to look at a thing like this. And you can sort of see that on some level, there's something in the popular culture where some people are onto the game. They see what's coming. They see what the actual status, they see where things are headed. And one of the things that's cool about this movie is that for all its like sentimental liberalism and its belief that, you know, decency and kindness can win the day, it is also crystal clear in its belief that like conservatism, not MAGA, not like right. the extreme right, conservatism as it was being sort of conceptualized and redefined in America, you know, in the 2010s, was rotten to the core, and all its respectability and like relatability was a mask for absolutely like murderously psychotic beliefs.
Yeah, but
is it? Is it implied that the tumor that he has is affecting this decision at all?
A little bit. I think
right.
It is.
That lorazepam certainly isn't doing its job.
Yeah. I do feel like that.
There's too many other people involved, right? Like that's sort of like once they invoke the speaker, it's like that goes beyond just a. Yeah. What did it say? Like, he was picking out like. His favorite white nationalist from the threat matrix, the daily threat matrix. but I mean, even to that point, and I, like this, you know, like this speaks to that tension between like Emmerich's rah-rah and the script's like sort of like baked in skepticism, you know, to your point, Rob, about how it sort of like points the finger at like the rot of conservatism writ large. It also points to what would happen later of like, well, the radicalized fringes that are mobilized on the right will just be co-opted as weapons by that like mainstream conservatism and will just we'll just hide behind whatever cloaks it needs to enact what it actually wants to occur and then can blame it on the fringes rather than what itself is doing.
I think that there's a tension that we're kind of talking about that I don't know if that is resolved in its like that the film that like this is a movie that believes, like Rob said, that conservatism at its core is a mask for these particular beliefs, right? This is established. But the problem is that it does not understand that the military itself, right, as a social institution, is fundamentally tied to those beliefs.
Because Emmerich would never let that happen. Like, right, all exactly. of his films are explicitly, like Bay, like many films that use military imagery are made, you know, in collaboration. Like, the reason they can use that imagery and use that weaponry is because you need that shit on loan from the military itself. And so they, you know, that's, but also I don't think it's as simple as that. That's more Bay. Emmerich, like, again, like, all of his stuff is rah-rah, and always has been.
And, like, the military-industrial complex as an idea is like, oh, yeah, this is about, you know, particular monetary and political interests. The film says that, but believes that, like, the military, that the problem with the military-industrial complex is the industrial part. Like, that is the fundamental belief of this movie, and it's just, like, that isn't enough. And it will never be able to make the further steps that it would need to actually, like, produce a salient critique, because it can't see that.
And these movies just don't do that, right? Like, the best you can hope for is that it's, like, a mess of, like, it helps them land, right? Like, the best ones, like, it helps, like, these big spectacle movies stand out if at least there's a mess of interesting ideas that don't necessarily cohere into anything, because it's, I don't know, what example even is there of a cohesive block, like, ideologically interesting blockbuster that operates at this scale? I'm sure it exists, it's just not coming to mind.
Well, I mean, the
or at least one that leans left, right? Like,
right, that's the thing.
Most blockbusters lean right. They're inherently, maybe not necessarily like capital C conservative, but like are broadly middle of the pack politically and ideologically at best. Mostly because they call them four quadrant movies. Everyone's got to watch it, and it's like liberals will still show up to a pro military movie. Conservatives might not show up to an anti military movie.
Exactly.
I also think, like, a thing I tend to, like, have a bit of, like, I'd be cautious about is, I think a lot of movies like this that are made from, like, a lot of works that come from a fundamentally, like, liberal belief system, it's not that they, like, can't get to conclusions or they can't see things.
Right.
It's that they just fundamentally disagree.
Right. No, exactly.
Like, it is, like, I don't think, like, this movie is confused about, like, oh, it can't quite, like, figure out where to place the military and all. Yeah, it can. The military is an institution that is a bulwark against this chaos. Mm-hmm. And it is vital to prevent it from falling into the wrong hands, i.e. the way that the Speaker of the House nearly inveigles himself to like, seize control of the entire apparatus. Like, I think, like, for us, it's very clear. The movie is identifying a lot of symptoms, but doesn't really have a compelling causal theory of, like, what is driving a lot of what it is like trying to represent. But in really, like, key, like, important ways, it is also deeply, like, it is deeply committed to this idea that, you know, the military itself and the people who comprise it can be separable from these problems, that they are divorceable from this. And what should be implicated and considered is, in fact, like, yeah, lobbying, the military industrial complex, et cetera.
Sten's the one, like, American military guy on the other side that, like, they give a, like, reason for, right? Like, he got burned.
What is his, do you remember what his motivation was?
Well, I mean, essentially, like, he was in deep undercover in the Middle East,
yes.
And his identity got burned, and he spent 2 years in a
Taliban prison.
Yeah, Taliban prison, right? So, like, for him, it is a revenge story. Like, he's gung ho about actually, like, possibly killing the president for that specific action,
but not fully synced up with Woods.
The,
like,
reason,
as far as Woods wants to go, yeah.
But then you have Channing Tatum as a vet on the other end, being, like, the hero of the story, also. And, like, the reason that this one U.S. military guy gets to be this way is because he was wronged, right? Like,
yeah.
The rest of the military, as they show up, like Ren was saying earlier in the discussion, they're always making the right choices, even if they get thwarted by the bad guys. They're not more
the one call out, I think Lance Reddick is pretty clearly out to lunch for a lot of this movie. You know what I mean? Like the dude in the Pentagon, he always feels like he's a bit of a martinet who is trying to, like, very rigid in his reaction to these things.
Yeah, it just feels like he's trying to do the best job, and like he sees the other institutions as fundamentally corrupted and corruptible because of the connection. Like, right, they at the very beginning, he's like, somebody's been compromised in your office, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that this ties into a thing about a lot of movies that fall into this mold and that like emerge from this particular worldview, is that there is the idea that the bureaucracy, there's the simultaneous idea that like institutions like the military can be a bulwark against like bad actors, right? But it also believes that bureaucracy as a system is antithetical to good actors doing what they need to. And it honestly reminds me a lot of, think about this through like the lens of the film Contagion a ton. Contagion is a movie that is completely convinced that simultaneously that bureaucracy is what causes like tragedy and disaster, and also that good bureaucrats are the answer to that problem. And I think that Reddick's character is very much the man, all this bureaucracy is getting in the way of what needs to get done, because all of these processes, and he's just too deep within it. And like the movie, because like, who's the person who gets things done? It is the outsider. It is the person who is not part of this specific organizations and bureaucracy, right?
If they had just told the president Independence Day earlier about the existence of aliens instead of the defense secretary keeping that from them and doing their private research experiments, could have been all avoided.
Yes, exactly.
Ren, I know you got to go, but before you do,
yes,
two quick questions. Flag twirling, thumbs up or thumbs down? And
as talent?
The reveal, the payoff for the flag twirling.
Rob's trying to figure out if you
good or horrible. And two, tour guide. Do you ship him and Emily's mom?
I've been thinking about it since the movie turned off. I have not been able to stop thinking about that fucking dork. I think that is one of the, it's a really stupid joke. It's a joke I like a lot, of him being like, so do you want a free tour of the White House? It's great. I love it. It's so dumb. I want them to be together because he's a dork and I want him to have a W. You know, I want the buddy cop movie with him and Emily, where it's just like the two of them getting in.
They actually don't like each other at first. Like, she's an annoying kid on the tour.
But by the end, he's picking up that shotgun for her, and he will
die
do
for this
anything.
Child.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I love this kid who knows more than I do. That's great. And the flag twirling reveal is so fucking stupid. I love it so much. Waving the flag to get the jets off is incredible. I could not be happier.
All right, Ren, we will let you go. We'll wrap the show from here. But thanks for hanging. Thanks for getting so invested.
Sorry, I've liked this movie a lot more than I thought I did.
Yeah,
this has been a joy.
That's right. I will say the flag twirling thing did put me in mind, though, of like, it's again, this movie's just lifting shit from The Rock. This is the green smoke sequence from The Rock, where they're about to like drop the thermite plasma on Alcatraz, and he sends the signal and all that, and it's all like the cross cutting, it's hyper dramatic. The fact they do it with her running out with the flag, which she knows how to twirl and signal and get attention because she did it as a talent show, which we introduced in the first 15 minutes of the movie. The audacity to do that. Just incredible.
At least it wasn't the U.S. flag. They held back just a little bit. What was that? Was like the seal of the White House or something?
Was that it?
I think so. It was blue.
It was a predominantly blue flag
with like a seal in the center.
I don't know exactly which.
But yeah, that just I like beautiful. Wrote down like, oh, okay, here's our liberty leading the people moment of just like she's running out with this flag. This is very funny. mostly also the reaction from the like the guy is like, but there's a kid with a flag. We can't do the mission. It's like, yeah, okay.
You were already knew the assignment.
Yeah, the assignment was
already going
shoot
to be
the building where there's hostages
killing
inside
a bunch of
it.
Civilians.
Yeah.
Yes, you knew that.
You
and don't we remember earlier? This girl has a video that has been seen 700 million times on her YouTube channel, not her blog. And her my YouTube guess channel. Is you're aware of that information because you were watching the news today and the news kept crediting her over the bravery of this young little girl. So, I mean, but whatever. Like, those sequences are not meant to be logically consistent. They are meant to be emotionally consistent.
Right.
Like, they are just meant to tug at your heartstrings. And I don't know that it necessarily accomplishes that, but that is definitely what it's going for rather than, anything else. Also, yep. The Wikipedia says it was a presidential flag, whatever that means.
It's a shame we didn't get the sequence where she's found by the terrorists, as just messages pour in from media outlets asking permission to use her video.
One of the comments like,
do you mind if we use this on NBC News?
Well, credit.
I hope you're safe. Can you just let me know?
Oh, man.
Can I just use this?
When the little girl, that great sequence where it's Jason Clark, right? Goes in to intimidate her, smacks her around, and then she just steely-eyed, get away from me. And she breaks him. Like, that part was awesome. Like, he does not know what the fuck to do with this little girl. And she stared him in the eyes and said, get away from me. And he did. He did, like a cowering lion. He did.
It's terrific. We didn't even, there isn't much to say about the hacker dude, but the fact there's a shitty little hacker dude, because yeah. Basically,
oh, and of course it's got the classical music because that's just
Die Hard.
The bit.
Yeah. Yep.
And he gets hoisted by his own little trap that he left in the tunnels. It is such a goofy film. I don't think I have much more to say about it. I think it's like, this is where I come down is like, it is a surprising popcorn flick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just wish it was like 40 minutes shorter. Like, it'd be so much easier to recommend if it was like an hour 40 instead of 2 hours and 15 minutes. Like, there's like an edited version of this film that is, even for all its like existing faults, if you were just to take it and trim it down, I think would be like a much stronger film as a result.
Yeah, there's a more diehard-y version where they never leave the White House, even into the tunnels, and are just like crawling in vents and like going through various different rooms that you saw on the tour beforehand, like more right
God, than when, oh the payoff with the tour guy dude when he gets to deliver his one liner. Oh, he whacks that dude with the whatever he was holding. That was probably my favorite reoccurring bit was that character. It had such a good payoff.
Can we talk? One of my favorite reoccurring bits is the fucking shitty Republican guy.
Oh yeah, the Fox News dude is there.
The Fox News dude. The fucking. he was a senator though, right? Yeah.
Was he?
Yes, he's a senator, but he also has his own like talk show apparently. Which is like they're kind of mixing a couple different types of guys.
No, I think he's just a talk show personality.
I swear someone called him a senator. No? Okay.
Maybe he's next. But like, but also again.
But the point being, him being there and like that, the fucking Nazi guy being like, oh my God, I love your work the whole time.
And in terms of like the thing being, like the film sort of being like keyed to some currents in all this.
Yeah.
Like, the degree to which this guy is blanching it, like, oh God, this thing is happening. The shit that I like stir up and encourage like every day on TV is actually happening, and it scares the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Because I'm caught up in it. Because the people who are like my friends actually terrify me suddenly, like my ideological sympathizers kind of scare me. And just the degree to which he is like, like blanching from the minute they identify him as like one of theirs. So the minute the character played by Kevin Rankin is like, man, you're right, and is asking basically for a job, like, can I intern on your show? Like, just incredible. There's a lot of good shit in this movie. Like, I end up being pretty won over by it, and I think that is in spite of all the issues you mentioned, Patrick. Like, I think Roland Emmerich fumbles a lot of major things about this film, but the script, the characterizations, you all kind of come away from being like, yep, this is it's still pretty winning.
He loses when him and Dean Devlin split post Godzilla. If you look at the, because they did Stargate together, Independence Day together, and maybe Universal Soldier. I don't know. The split occurs around like the Patriot Godzilla era, or maybe it was with the Patriot with this. But either way, like, there's like a heart that is lost. Yeah. Like, after, like, post, where it becomes just increasingly cranked on the spectacle. And I think you can just like see that here. Like, there's, again, like, it's easy to see a world where like this movie is like an all-timer, like, with like some tweaks and like tonally just like moved around a little bit. Like, it does, you don't have to, like, the pieces are all there. The bones are very good on this movie, which is why it's as entertaining as it is.
Okay, you're up to that Midway movie that nobody liked either. Yeah,
no, he's like post Devlin, like, essentially the only successes he has are I Know How to Destroy New York. Would you like to see it done a different way? And frequently the answer is yes. I would like to see that. But yeah, he just loses a touch with the split from with Dean Devlin, and it's too bad, because I think with someone like his presence here, this movie is probably something a lot more special.
I think we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for listening to My Turn. Thanks to Tumelo for the theme music. And if you are listening to this through Waypoint Plus, we are grateful for your support. And if you're on the public feed and you might be listening to this without, you know, and you're thinking, boy, I wish it were a week early and there weren't all these ads, well, head over to waypointplus.com and sign right up. Everyone, also, please leave a review on iTunes. That is the most helpful kind of review you can leave. You can follow me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Kato, where can people find you?
@A_Kato_appears.
Patrick.
@PatrickLupik.
Believe it or not, is @RenorRaven. And as for next week, well, it's not my turn anymore. I think Kato, like, the play passes to you, correct?
It's my turn.
Yeah.
My turn.
You've had some time to think about this. Now, you seemed pretty convinced you knew what you wanted to pick.
I think I do. I think I considered some other options, but I think we're heading towards...
Olympus has fallen.
We're headed towards the house that the Coen brothers built. We're going to Hail Caesar.
Hell yes.
Wow, that's one of the few
good
I haven't
pull.
Seen. That's one of the few.
Channing Tatum in Hail Caesar is going to be a very interesting thing to compare to him in this movie. I'll tell you that. So yeah, check that movie out for get ready for next time on My Turn.
Excellent. I can check it off my list. I don't know why I didn't watch that when it came out some years back, but I know it's very good.
So good.
All right. So keep an eye out for that coming up soon on My Turn. For now, peace.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.